hey there. I'm Margaret Wappler, filling in for Guy Branum, who's in New York this week. Welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are my women's digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, darling. And academic, Karen Thompson.
Hey, women's.
Women's.
With extra Ys.
Women's, like, with an extra so many Ys. Some Zs.
Coming up in this week's show, is there a Grammys So White problem? We're going to find out with pop music critic Chris Malamphy. He's going to join us to argue his case. And we're all going to talk about our Grammys highlights and lowlights. And you know what? I just want to say right now that I want to cuddle a Chance the Rapper because he dresses like a toddler, most of all.
Yeah, it's sickening.
Right?
It's
like sickening. His little overalls?
He's like an oversized Muppet.
You know, I always do toddler check before I leave the house. I ask my wife, do I look like a toddler today?
It's a hazard.
Sometimes I kind of look like that, like right now.
Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen? What's caught your attention?
It's something that's had my attention for a while, but it is a version of my comfort TV, and I think it's the unsung hero of the NBC primetime comedy lineup. Not that there are many heroes in that lineup.
Straight up.
But I really enjoy Superstore, which is comedy.
Tell us about that. I don't know what it is at all.
So Superstore is set in a Walmart-esque superstore called Cloud Nine in St. Louis. St. Louis, Missouri.
And good pronunciation.
It's created. Yeah, I'm sure they'll love that out there. And the showrunner is Justin Spitzer, who also worked on The Office. So it has that kind of workplace comedy vibe with a mix of deadpan, strange, idiosyncratic storylines and a kind of motley crew of characters. I wanted to pay special attention or give a shout out to the Gaijin Filipino-American actor who's one of the leads on the show, Nico Santo, who plays Mateo. And first of all, I love that there are more and more Filipino-American roles on TV, which is really exciting. But Nico Santo really gets to play this full character who's a bit of a goody two-shoes at the same time that he's embroiled in a secret gay romance with someone in corporate.
And general so romances funny. With corporate.
Exactly. You know? And he's so funny. And I really... I just like lost my thread for a minute.
Yeah, because the dog farted.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He does that sometimes. We did not mention that Flynn Wappler Earl is in the studio at the moment, and he's been a very good boy. He's been dazzling us with his downward dog stretches, he also just dumped a bomb on us.
Yeah. But to me, I also appreciate that it's kind of like what I imagine an ecumenical Red State set show could be. Mm. And it's funny. I think it has a lot of entry points for a lot of people from a lot of different perspectives. So watch Superstore and thanks, Flynn, for the toots.
Thanks for the farts.
Yeah. Toots bagoots. Winter, what are you all about this week?
It's the season premiere of the final season of Girls. And I found this week's episode, the premiere, I found it so rewarding in that it's finally addressing some things, and it addressed it really quickly at the top about the characters that I've always have driven me nuts. And it's sort of like they were, I think when you're in your 20s, listen, when you're in your 20s, you're sort of just like wallowing and doing whatever you're doing. And then at some point you just figure it out. I'm even a late bloomer for sort of figuring it out. But one thing I can say is that Hannah, Lena Dunham's character, has finally just accepted the fact that she's in a clique that does not click. And it is, you know, she's written about, I don't know if you guys, did you guys watch last season?
I did watch it.
I thought the last season was the best one so far.
Season 5 was amazing.
It was great.
In the season opener, we have her writing a modern love article.
For the
New York Times. That
always getting those good jobs.
She really does get good jobs.
I know.
Hannah gets great jobs.
Yeah. She doesn't really deserve them, but nevertheless.
She gets great jobs. But by the way, I can relate to her on that. Sometimes I deserve them. Sometimes I don't really deserve them. But you just kind of do it. She's losing her best friend. and which is Jessa, to Adam, which is her ex-boyfriend. They're in a relationship now. And I liked her, the way they sort of like dealt with that in a really pat way. Mm-hmm. What I think people don't understand, and I hope they will be able to understand as they watch the show and as it evolves further, is that she reminds me of Peter Sellers a little bit.
Oh, just, yeah.
Yeah, her approach, she makes herself the butt of the joke.
Yes.
So often that people think it's gratuitous, when in fact, the onus is kind of on her. It's something that really, you know, when you look at Sex and the City, Carrie never was willing to sort of put herself that deep into it.
She wasn't willing to make a true ass of herself.
No, she wasn't willing to make a true ass of herself. And something that Issa Rae did with Insecure and something that Lena's doing with Hannah is making herself the butt of the joke and making things as awkward as possible, because I defy anyone. Your life is completely boring if you've never had any one of these experiences that have occurred in a girl's episode. Your life is just truly boring.
I'm excited.
Me too.
Okay, I have a very quick one. Basically, this would go into my political survival kit, along with Randy Rainbow's videos, yes. Are the videos of Vic Berger.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I turned you on to him after I put that Bob Dylan.
Oh, no. That I think the one you put up that made me discover him was that Trump's big announcement one. So basically, Vic Berger has been taking moments of the election and the fallout after the election and turning them into these highly surreal, absurdist, viral videos. And the Trump's very big announcement one is really magical, where basically, like, he does ridiculous things. Like, he'll just repeat the image of Trump, like, coming down on the escalator, like, going back and forth. And like,
I love it.
Oh, yeah. And like this morning, I just happened to watch this like 1 minute thing that he threw up of Stephen Miller going on to the various news shows and talking about voter suppression, and particularly the moment where George Stephanopoulos is just having none of it.
Yeah.
And basically it's like, you have no evidence. And he just like calls out the whole absurdity of the moment with Stephen Miller just like blinking like a deer in headlights, like having no real like response to this. And one of his very, very ridiculous and insane videos, and it's insane because it's actually pretty real. I mean, they're all real, but this one you can't believe is real. It's Jim Baker, the televangelist, who now is on TV selling various buckets of food for the end days.
Let's talk about the bucket of food, though, Margaret.
So the particular video that's
going to save us from hellfire
that we're all going to live on here in the booth with Flynn is the Fiesta bucket. Okay, right there, it's like,
smell real good in here.
Fiesta. By the way, we're bucket. Supposed to eat the bucket and then shit in it after. Literally.
Yeah, I mean, Fiesta and bucket, those two words should never really go together.
Fiesta bucket.
But they do in Jim Baker's sad, weird bucket. Mind.
I think I've eaten a Fiesta bucket.
So basically, Vic Berger takes this already completely ludicrous premise and just spins it into more absurdist magic. So we have a little clip of Jim Baker talking about how good the Fiesta bucket is.
I'm supposed to be introducing this right here. This is so many different kinds of foods.
Hey,
can you all see that right there? There's an enchilada. This is 20 year shelf life food, and I put some of that cheese sauce on the taco. It is so good.
That's called queso. Cheese sauce is called queso.
Oh, dear.
Queso.
There's a woman there who's holding a baby.
His
new wife, Tammy Faye, is
Tammy
now dead.
Tammy Faye, right?
And no doubt watching from heaven. But at any rate, this woman that's there is holding this baby, and she just chimes in every once in a while with very strange things, it's called queso.
The comments are, Jesus Christ, can you ship to the UK, please? I'm going to have to dig into this. Only two comments. Listen, don't buy this shit.
Only two.
Only don't buy the. There's a 30-day.
Can we buy one for Pop Rocket?
I think we
need
to.
There's a fruit and vegetable vault.
I want to try the Fiesta bucket.
Oh, let's do it.
All right, guys. We're going to go order the Fiesta bucket. You've been listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk Grammys 2017 after this.
Are you sad and confused about world politics? Worried about the upcoming inevitable nuclear war? Or maybe a rat is living in your house? There's a rat living in my house. How do you get rid of a rat from a house? why not immerse yourself in a completely fictional, imagined podcast for the beef and dairy industries? It works for me. The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is the number one podcast for those involved, or just interested, in the production of beef animals and dairy herds. Don't worry, it's funnier than it sounds. Find us at beefanddairynetwork.com or maximumfun.org, or wherever you get your podcast from. Oh God, there's the rat. Oh God.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler. With me in the studio are Winter Mitchell and Karen Tongson. We'll get to the Grammys talk in just a second, but I wanted to take a moment and encourage everyone to join the Pop Rocket Facebook group. Winter, as our digital strategist, can you tell our listeners why they should join our Facebook group?
Because I imagine your timelines are a disaster currently. Your news feed, when you click that home button on Facebook, is probably a tragedy every single day. You are probably longing for the days of dog pictures, pictures of kids with food on their faces.
Pictures of food.
What
pictures
I wouldn't give for a smoothie shot at this point.
A smoothie shot. You'd look at a piece of yarn if you could. The thing about the Facebook group for Pop Rocket is that it's always a lively discussion about things that people are passionate about, which is the most important thing, and that's entertainment and pop culture. So I would encourage you to join the group for, if nothing else, it's a good way to spend 15 or 20 minutes in a deep discussion with like-minded folks that you can be snarky with abandon, and then you can jump out of it and go back to hating whomever it is that you didn't vote for. So just understand that it's a safe space. It's a hug box for snowflakes. it's chilly
you
in there.
You won't melt in our room.
You won't melt in our room. We're going to hug ya. But it's also a great place to talk about things you watch that you want other people to know about, or we can have a viewing thread like we did with the Grammys. It's a lively group, and shout out to some of the people that make it great. There's a lot of ambassadors in there that just kill it, and you will find that you will always have something to talk about, and it will always be welcome.
So, guys, we're here to talk about the Grammys this year. And I know that we were all on either Facebook or Twitter talking and watching them together. But I wanted to know from you guys what you thought of the show overall. Were you psyched to watch it? I don't think you were, right, Karen? Because I believe there was a tweet coming from your area, your neck of the woods, saying that you'd rather be doing pretty much anything else on Grammys night.
I would rather
laundry,
be eating a hoagie,
waiting for a bus,
stroll around the park, cleaning the cat litter. So given that, actually, I was kind of surprised how interested I managed to remain, especially when Chance the rapper started like notching a bunch of wins, and I was like, yeah. Oh yay, the Chainsmokers lost Best New Artist, and I've like had a little bit of hope. And you know, and then as always happens with the Grammys, excessive performances, strange segues, strange bursts of off-key a cappella from the young and the old. At one point I tweeted, can I just turn this off and watch the season premiere of Girls already?
Right. Have I paid my dues enough to turn on Girls now?
But it was fun talking to the folks on the Facebook group.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's always the best part of watching an awards show like this, is that you just end up watching it with your friends online. Winter, what about you? You were there in person.
Yeah, and I left an hour in.
Whoa.
So
ringing endorsement for this year's Grammys.
I mean, award shows as
you
a whole.
The Bee Gees tribute?
Oh, that stellar thing. gosh, I should have been front and center for that. There's something about going to these things versus actually watching them. And I would never recommend that a person that's a fan of music goes to the Grammys, because it completely strips all the whimsy and amazement that you have when you're like at a live performance, because it's so structured and controlled, and then people are doing it for the ratings. Of all the Grammys that I've watched, I gotta say, I don't know what to make of it anymore. I don't know what to make of
the Grammys in general, like the telecast.
All of it. I don't know what to make of it, because there was something really fun about watching the Grammys as a kid and watching like, you know, people make these statements and kind of be themselves, and everybody was like sort of an indicative of who their persona was. And now even, and this is going to get me so much hate, but like, I love Beyonce as much as the next person, but maybe not. But there's something so not authentic, inauthentic about everything that happened last night. And I still think she should have won. But I think the reason that I don't want to, like, everybody's trying to make the Adele versus Beyonce scenario a race thing. And while there are many things in the world right now we can drill down to racial disparity, I don't see that here. I see two talented women, but I also see someone who's a lot more reserved in their approach to music. Like, they both leave everything on the floor, but there's an authenticity with Adele. There's just she got up there and was authentic, talking mm-hmm. about being like, it's hard being a mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I believe it's hard being a mom. This girl was plucked from obscurity. I mean, she was not groomed for this world. She wasn't.
No, she's like the dead opposite of dead opposite Beyonce of Beyonce. In that way.
And Beyonce, I think, is starting to see, in spite of all of her. All of the things that make her Beyonce, she's starting to see, like, you're getting into this. It reminds me of, like, when I think of her career, I think of, like, a riverboat. Like, you need that big-ass wheel on the back to keep it going. But you see that shit every day, and you're like, oh, that's the riverboat. I know exactly what it's doing. And mm-hmm. I feel like she's not, you know, with Lemonade was such a crazy, powerful statement. But I can't imagine that she is surprised that there is this reverberation back in a negative manner, probably from the Academy, probably from people mad about the Super Bowl. There's something going on here that's not getting her to where she needs to be. And I just can't be a fan right now. I have to look at it for what it is. I do think Adele's album 21 and 25 are the same thing. But if we're also talking about the Grammys being a part of, like, their persona comes to it, I got to go with someone who feels like a little, like, I can have a beer with Adele. I can't have a beer with Beyonce.
Mm. She's just left the beer zone.
Yeah, she's just left. She's never entered the beer zone. She doesn't do that. She doesn't do dive bars. It's not her thing.
Well, I want to talk more for sure about Adele and Beyonce in that moment. But I just want to go back for a minute to how strange I think the Grammys are when you're there watching them in person.
Yeah.
Karen, have you ever been to the Grammys?
I have not been to the Grammys, no.
I've been there a few times as a reporter, and I was shocked the first time about how anticlimactic it is to be in the audience watching it, because it really is an event made for television. It's not about being there live in person at all. It's all disjointed and weird when you're there live, mm-hmm. because there's parts of the magic, you know, you're sort of seeing the wizard behind the curtain way too mm-hmm. often, and so all of the magic of it is stripped away. And granted, I do think the Grammys has always suffered from a little bit of, like, a low rent feel, you know, like, it doesn't.
Oh, my.
I mean, it just doesn't feel as, like, sharp and beautiful as the Oscars can feel at, like, the top of their mm-hmm. game. Like, the production mm-hmm. values are always just a little bit chintzier. I hate to say it, but it's true. So I think when you're there in person, like, you just really see that. At play.
Oh, you see all of it. And then, like, I could see the people that were getting ready to do the other stuff, like getting the sets ready behind. And I could just see it. It was such a distraction.
All the stagecraft, yeah, all the seat fillers.
All of it. Getting all rid of all those fucking flowers Beyonce brought. I was like, these guys. Poor guys. There's so many fucking flowers.
She's really going through a lot of flowers lately.
So many.
I hope she's planted a rose garden somewhere.
I really hope so.
Although, I do have to say, I do think of the Grammys as something, like you, Winter, that totally pleased me when I was a child and that I was actually super excited about. Even when I was really, really little and saw Neil Diamond and Barbara Streisand saying, "You don't bring me flowers," you know, and when they're, like, kind of coyly touching each other's faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super cheesy, but I remember thinking even then that I witnessed a moment. Like, it registered to me that there was something special happening on stage. And in fact, it was less produced insofar as there weren't as many kind of crazy sets.
That's
and
true.
Like
sure.
moving parts. It was just them standing on a kind of black stage.
Yeah.
Holding their weird dildonic, like, white microphones, like, singing to each other. And that's so nice and simple. Whereas, like, all the numerous, I think, projections and effects certainly, like, read well on TV, but as I was watching it on TV, I was like, that must be for the people in Staples, you know, like, in
it is not know. It was not. I'm gonna let you know.
Yeah, who is it for? I don't know.
I don't know who it's for. But I also think there's something like interesting about the devolution of music and how it correlates to these things. I feel like music is off the rails in a big way. The industry, not music itself. But yeah. I feel like the industry has never recovered from 9/11, music sharing. I feel like there's just no way to hone in this interest in a way that the Recording Academy can control and the way that an artist can control. I mean, to deal with what they dealt with last night, having five major artists completely be like, I don't want to be there. I'm not interested in being there. Like, these aren't fake artists. We're talking about Drake, Justin Bieber, Kanye, for what it's worth. And there's a couple more.
Frank Ocean didn't even put his album into running.
Yeah.
You know, and that people will call that a Katie Heigl moment, but I don't think that's a Katie Heigl moment. I think it's a personal choice. I just think that there is a problem within the music industry that people feel like they're not getting what they deserve and they don't want to be paraded at some event where they're just being used for ratings. I personally don't see anything wrong with resisting that.
Yeah, I also think they haven't recovered or caught up with the changes in the way people process and listen to music now. I mean, the fact that this was the first year that they have caught up to streaming in the sense that they made streaming-only albums, they let those in this time, which is how Chance, the rapper, basically got his award for Coloring Book, which is great. Like, they should have opened that up for him and anyone else that's had a streaming-only album. But that to me, just feels like 5-7 years too late. You know, would have been interesting. It's the Grammys is always notoriously behind on recognizing what the industry is doing and creating awards that can then accommodate those changes. And this is just like an example of it at play where it's like, why didn't you guys do this a while ago when it would have been cutting edge and fresh? But cutting edge and fresh is just never the Grammys' strong suit.
They've got to seriously pull it together, though. They've got to get with the time.
Although I do have to say, I think that another reason that Lemonade could not win for Album of the Year is because it was such a multimedia event. And I think that there was a way in which it was very easy to create an excuse not to be able to reward something that had to rely on another medium, i.e., you know, film and video and the whole thing. And I think that there's something about that, particularly for a conservative and older Grammy voting bloc, that's just like, well, that's not real music. It, you know, it's a bunch of visual tricks and we're meant to, you know, it's not pure in some way.
Yeah, like they don't get that the thing that's really magical about Lemonade is this multi-dimensional packaging of it. Mm-hmm. And the visual aspect in particular, I mean, Lemonade, the little film, is amazing and beautiful, but if you didn't watch it, I don't know that the album would sound as good to you. I don't know that it would resonate as much. And then you have, of course, like all the political ramifications of that record.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, it being a topic and an approach, you know, basically blackness in America, being a black woman in America, that a lot of the Recording Academy voting bloc just doesn't understand. Mm-hmm. And doesn't understand it, especially when it is presented in this multidimensional format. We have a special guest, chart analyst and pop critic for Slate and Pitchfork, Chris Malanfi, here on the line to talk Grammys with us. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
All right. Trying to recover from staying up too late, both watching the Grammys and tweeting about the Grammys last night, but otherwise I'm good.
So Karen was just about to tell us about a tweet that you made last night.
Yeah, and I think it was one of the more sort of prescient comments early on in the broadcast after Beyoncé accepted her Grammy for Best Urban
Urban Contemporary album.
I was like, Urban Contemporary, that is so vague. But Best Urban Contemporary Album, and she made that really what I thought was one of the best sort of condensed political and thoughtful speeches that I've ever seen on an awards show.
Mm-hmm. Here,
and
here.
Chris tweeted, and I hate to say it, but she got that all out now because she knows she's not going to win, basically.
Right.
And so, I don't know, Chris, do you want to tell us when you, I mean, it was kind of obvious, but like some thoughts on early on.
Yeah, like how did you know that that was the case? What made you think that?
It was an inkling I had. I, you know, the Grammys now have a somewhat tormented relationship, not just with Black music in general, but Beyonce in particular. Mm. I mean, this is now, and we can now officially say it, and I predicted this would happen, but I'm even more depressed that it came true. This is now the second time in 3 years that Beyonce went into the Album of the Year contest with an album widely critically acclaimed as one of the year's best, in this case, probably the year's best, and she lost to something more anodyne and white bread and middle of the road. And I had a feeling, particularly going into last night, that, you know, the Grammy forefathers, Naris, et cetera, knew that if they didn't give Beyonce some airtime, even if Adele swept everything, there would be even greater hell to pay. I think, frankly, a day later, they're still paying some hell for what happened. Mm-hmm. But they better, come hell or high water, make sure that she got some airtime, in addition to her performance, that she wins something on the air. Because, to digress for a moment, what makes the Grammys exceptional as an award show compared to, say, the Oscars? The Oscars actually televises every last award, right? Yes. There's something like 30 Oscars, and they all make the telecast. The Grammys can't possibly put everything on the telecast, and they are the most shameless of any award show, even more than the Emmys, at just cutting stuff. It's like, nope, we're going to put 8 or 9 awards on the telecast, maybe 10, and the rest is all performance, performance, performance. By the way, I consider this a feature, not a bug. This is a good thing. But they can therefore be selective. There are the big 4 prizes, right? There's Album of the Year, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best New Artist. Those are on no matter what. But then they can kind of be selective about the genre prizes that they put on. And I've been trying to research this all day, and I'm not sure I have a definitive answer on this, but Urban Contemporary Album as a prize has only existed for about a dozen years, and I'm not sure it has ever been televised before. So the minute I saw that they were putting that one on, I mean, talk about a random prize. It's not even the only or necessarily the flagship R&B prize. Mm. That smelled to me of the fix is in. And it was an act of, I don't know, mercy or ass covering, take your pick, by Naris to ensure that, boy, Beyonce released what everybody agrees was the best album last year, except for Grammy voters. We damn well better give her some hardware live on the air.
Well, I know you're a great numbers cruncher, so I want to ask you to do some number crunching, in particular with Adele's album 25 versus Lemonade, mm-hmm. because some mm-hmm. people have made the argument that, like, look, Adele's 25 did sell way more than Lemonade did. So is that why it won, or what is the deciding factor? Basically, how did the Grammys voter bloc come to this decision?
Well, I mean, like all award shows, you know, I find Oscar prognosticators often talk about this. You can't necessarily speak about a voting body as if they have one mind, right? On the other hand, they definitely have tendencies and predilections. The answer to the question, does sales matter, has frankly bedeviled the Grammys throughout its 60-year history. Mm-hmm. The Grammys has always been a prize that is supposed to reward art, not commerce, but everybody knows it's an industry prize, and commerce absolutely factors in. You know, the number of session players factors in, like the more people who are getting work from this album factors in. The extent to which it kept the industry afloat last year, and God knows 25 kept the industry afloat in the prior 12 months, given that it sold tonnage that no other album this decade has sold, except for Adele's prior album, 21. So all of these things definitely factor in. What's sort of insidious, though, about the argument, well, of course, it sold more, ergo it won, argument, is that when Beyonce lost just 3 Grammys ago, 2 years ago in early 2015, she lost to an album by Beck. Yeah. By the way, I'm a fan of Beck, but, like, even as a fan of Beck, Morning Phase, the album that won in 2015, is not even the 5th best Beck album. Like, yeah. On a good day, it's the 6th or 7th best Beck album.
And
it beat
sell?
Beyonce's self-titled 2013 album. I mean, yeah. So, and since you asked me about number crunching, going into the night in 2015, Beck's Morning Phase had sold 300,000 copies. There are albums that debuted to more than 300,000 copies.
Wow.
It had sold 300,000 copies cumulatively. So the argument that, of course Adele won, she sold more, is hogwash.
Yeah.
And that's when you have to explore these other answers, how race factors in, how genre factors in. If I'm being charitable, you know, obviously everybody's fomenting a Grammy So White controversy the day after, and I don't think they're wrong. If when you look through the history of the Grammys, particularly in the Album of the Year prize, the numbers are stark. Something like 12 to 13, depending on how you count some of the albums that were various artists' albums, 12 to 13 albums have, by people of color, have won the Album of the Year prize in 59 years. That's not a great record. And by the way, three of them are a streak by Stevie Wonder in the 70s. So already there haven't been that many black artists that have won it. There have been wins by, you know, Ray Charles. After he passed away, there was a win by Herbie Hancock for an album full of, you know, Joni Mitchell covers, mm-hmm. you know, back
Natalie
in 2008.
Cole's Unforgettable, right?
It was called River, the Joni Letters, and yeah, and that had sold the smallest amount going into Grammy night of any Album of the Year winner ever. So, you know, the Grammys have a race problem, arguably. I would say they also have a genre problem. Mm-hmm. If you want to be charitable, you could say that their bigger problem really is hip-hop, right? Because, for example, 6 years ago, I think this was, 2011 show, the Arcade Fire won for the Suburbs. Total upset victory. Nobody saw it coming. The favorite going into that night was actually Eminem with Recovery. Mm-hmm. So, and Eminem had won the Best Rap Album prize something like 5 times. If Eminem drops an album, it pretty much wins the Best Rap Album prize. But he's actually got the same problem as most black artists who go for the big prizes do. He never wins the big prizes. So going into the night, mm-hmm. you know, and I happen to like the Arcade Fire. I happen to think the Suburbs is a terrific album. But, like, you knew that the reason why the Suburbs won the Album of the Year prize wasn't because, you know, Naris had all of a sudden become a bunch of, you know, hipster fans of the Arcade Fire. It was because it was an album full of, you know, people who play instruments, and they didn't want to reward the heavily favored hip-hop album going into the night. So it's mostly a race problem, but I also think it's a bit of a genre problem. And I think as Beyonce in particular has moved further in the direction of R&B that is heavily cross-pollinated with hip-hop, it has made her more alien to, you know, the larger voting body. At least that's my theory.
Well, it seems, too, that, like, the political factor of any given album is an issue. I mean, Recovery, it wasn't political per se, but when I say political, I just mean, like, an edge factor. If there's a serious
sure.
edge factor, it seems like the Academy gets scared.
Definitely. Definitely. And you know, these folks have been, let's remember, these folks have been square since the prize was invented, right? These are the folks who, you know, gave Song of the Year to Michelle by the Beatles, like, you know, not even the Beatles' greatest song. So they will go for the square pick each and every time. You know, Naris about 20 years ago in the mid-90s got embarrassed enough at some of the albums that were winding up in the Album of the Year race that they actually revised the process. This is quite controversial. You'll see articles about this every year come Grammy time, about how the sausage gets made, where there are these nominating committees. It's not actually a pure vote. In the big categories, and in several of the genre categories, there are hand-picked nominating committees that meet in secret, and they factor in both the votes and some individual taste on the committee to determine what the nominees are. Frankly, I have never had a problem with this because given the sheer number of albums released in any given year, to some extent you have to save the voters from themselves, at least at the nominating level. So, you know, it's entirely possible, for example, that, you know, Beyonce's Lemonade didn't even make the top 5 vote getters and it was shoved into the category by the nominating committee. We'll never know, right? But some fairly tasteful people wind up, you know, lobbying for this or that album. The problem at the end of the day, though, is that when you present the choices to the voting body, they are going to home in like middle-brow lasers on the most, you know, middle-of-the-road, up-the-middle kind of record. And that's what they did with Adele's 25. Did sales factor in? Yeah, unquestionably. But, again, they also picked Beck 2 years ago. So they're looking for comfort food more than anything.
Hi, Chris. At what point should listeners, the average audience, start just tuning out the ceremony and the lead up to the ceremony as a whole? Because it sounds like, based on just everything that you so eloquently explained, the Grammys and the Academy are full of shit. So it doesn't seem like, to me, I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, you just made the sausage in front of me and cased it. I don't want it.
I'm what, so sorry.
That's usually my line.
Yes. Right.
Anyway.
I don't want any. But I just feel like, given what you've just explained, there's absolutely no reason to give them any credit for doing anything other than sort of making a mess of an already messy situation and then putting it on television.
I mean, all right, let me look at the glasses half full for a moment. I mean, I feel about the Grammys kind of the way I feel about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. It's easy to complain that this institution even exists, but as long as it exists, it is incumbent upon us who follow the industry and write about it, as Karen and I do, to hold their feet to the fire and at least try to make them get it right, you know, even though they get it wrong so often. And, you know, I will say one other thing, which is, and there were some clunker performances last night. I still don't know what that Bee Gees tribute was all about.
I don't know what that was.
The hell was that? I mean, never mind the fact that the Bee Gees had like a 30 to 40 year career and it focused on like 1.5 years of their entire history.
Exactly.
But anyway, setting that aside, to be positive for a moment, the Grammys is among the major award shows, probably the most entertaining award shows. Even if you throw out the half of the performances that you think are crap, there's always going to be something good on it. And because they have actually emphasized the performances over the awards, it's a show that moves, right? Like, they pack a lot in, and there are some legitimately memorable moments every year. So they put on a good show, and it's, I would say, in the last 15 to 20 years has actually gotten better than it used to be. I guess the other question I ask in terms of why should we give a crap about any of this, I mean, technically we've now had 3 consecutive years where a widely critically acclaimed consensus pick by an artist of color goes into the night with, I think in all 3 cases, the most nominations. I know it's true last year when Kendrick was up for the prize, mm-hmm. and loses to something middle of the road and by a white artist. So last year it was Kendrick's To Pimp a Butterfly. This year it was Beyonce's Lemonade. 2 years ago it was Beyonce's self-titled album. And, you know, when you get to a point where the artist who actually wins the prize this year, Adele, is telling you from the stage, you guys got this wrong, I think you have to take a good hard look at the process and say, maybe we need to fix this.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's now a tradition of white winners apologizing for their wins. I mean,
right,
you have Macklemore.
Right.
Apologizing to Beyonce. But Macklemore, too, belatedly.
I turned Macklemore into a verb in one of my tweets last night. I'm like, oh my God, did Adele just totally Macklemore Beyonce?
I'm sure he's fine with that. I know we have to wrap up, but I just have one really quick thing. Do you think that they're getting that black artists who have traditionally taken, except for Beyonce, have taken the non-traditional route towards getting an album together and then deploying it and distributing it? This might be some form of backlash by the Academy because they don't play by like label rules. A lot of these guys, you know, produce albums that are outside the system.
I mean, the counterexample to everything last night, and it's the argument everybody's been making to me in the last 24 hours that they claim shows, hey, we're not racist, is the win by Chance the Rapper last night. I mean, going into Best New Artist, a lot of people, myself included, were expecting that the Chainsmokers were going to take that Best New Artist prize.
And thank God they didn't.
At least there's justice.
Thank God
somewhere.
They didn't. Now, but you could see the math, right? You had 2 country artists, Kelsea Ballerini and Maren Morris. You had 2 rap and R&B, right? Anderson .Paak and Chance the Rapper. And then you had the Chainsmokers, and process of elimination, the Chainsmokers are going to take it. And then Chance wound up taking it. Chance wound up not only taking that, I believe he took Best Rap Album. I mean, he had quite a good night. And there's a guy who is completely outside of the mainstream. So I'm not sure what the message from that is. I mean, there's something very approachable and cuddly about Chance that, you know, made him Grammy catnip last night for whatever reason. But it's not like it was a terribly compromised album. So I don't know, maybe there's your glimmer of hope. But I'm not sure that it proves much in terms of, you know, the industry's predilections or tendency to, you know, default toward the white artist.
Well, Chris, I have a feeling we'll be talking to you again when Beyonce wins in like 10 or 15 years for her covers album
when
with
she gets
Michael
her lifetime
Bublé.
Her lifetime achievement award, basically.
Right.
Maybe
right.
she'll pull a Natalie Cole and she'll bring somebody back to life and sing with them and duet.
Right. Yeah. She's a hologram. She'll win at last. Thank you so much for talking with us tonight. It's
Bye,
really been
great.
It was
my pleasure.
Friend.
Thank you all.
All right. Talk
Take
to
care,
you soon.
Karen. Bye.
Okay. What did you guys think of Beyonce's performance?
I watched it twice, live and on tape. I think that I'm struggling with it a day later still because I feel like I've seen all of Beyonce's tricks. Mm. And I think that she is giving people what they want, her fans, but she's giving her base what they want. And I think I really want Beyonce to start thinking beyond her base. I know she doesn't have to because she's Beyonce, but for
her
some,
base is rather wide and massive, though.
No,
you know?
I completely get that. I mean, trust me, I completely get that. But there's just, I get where she was coming from. I get the ocean references. I get it all. But I also feel like, you know, she's just it's just worn. But this notion that Beyonce is the queen and we know that, but you start like giving it starts putting people in a state of like complacency where I think that she's not. I didn't feel like it changed game. Right. I feel like it did. It serviced what she given her condition and given like what the album's about and where she is. It serviced that. But, you know, I don't. It didn't. I was more taken by The Weeknd. I was more taken. I really loved his performance. I love him. I love Bruno Mars's energy. And I love the simplicity of Adele. I love that Adele can just stand on a stage, no instruments. And it's her. The only instrument is herself.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of it, Karen?
The Beyonce performance specifically. Yeah. I think that I see where you're coming from, Winter, around the kind of self-production as queen, right? In the whole kind of presentation of all of the kind of visual cues of her performance. But I think the thing that was remarkable about it to me was that it seemed utterly riveting and kind of strange and experimental, at least on TV when I first saw it. And I was like, who's watching this?
There's something to me quite riveting about it because it was so quiet and controlled and really pulled from more of this like yin energy than I've ever seen her pull from before.
Yeah.
It actually felt so much like a Solange performance.
Yes.
Like that.
Yes.
I felt
yes.
like it was so much more in Solange's wheelhouse yeah. of like this kind of like quiet, powerful wave of femininity. And it was still working on the goddess tip, which really Beyonce has been doing for a while now, mm-hmm. but it was a quieter form of the goddess tip. And like, yeah. I appreciated that shift in the energy. And I think it was just smart considering that she's not going to be able to dance her ass off, which wins yeah. at 6 months or whatever she is.
It brought people to a space of quiet and contemplation and being transfixed mm-hmm. rather than, you know, making them want to dance around and replicate the move. I mean, it was unreplicatable is the thing. You can't do like a kind of single lady, you know, it's not like single ladies or even aspects of formation where you can kind of in your own way mimic or try to mimic those gestures. It was just, it existed on its own. It was kind of blocked off also in the broadcast as this kind of strange, like temporal yeah. rupture. And then it's back to flashing lights and like fist pumps.
Yeah,
and
I mean, nothing
thing.
Else looked like it the yeah. whole telecast.
Yeah, so I thought it was stunning for those reasons.
Well, let's talk about some of the more political performances yeah. of the Grammys, because I do feel like it was an interesting night for that factor alone, that
yeah.
you had some people who aren't typically political showing that side of themselves, like Katy Perry. I mean, here she was, like, dancing in front of this fence that I guess was supposed to be, like the wall or something.
I thought it was like the White House.
It was like a picket fence, with white or pink and blue projections and flowers. She's wearing the white suffragette pantsuit.
Right.
And everybody thought she said resist, but apparently she said persist.
Yeah, the Elizabeth Warren moment where Mitch McConnell tried to shut her down.
And
right?
then, and it closes with her, with like the Constitution superimposed on that building. I do appreciate that Katy Perry like made the effort and is trying.
Yeah.
But killing with kindness. But the message persist versus the kind of explosion that you were saying. I thought it was the tribe performance. I think that people also just had a lot of deep feelings about, losing Fife and all that stuff. It's just like
the high water jeans that Q-Tip was wearing, his whole fashion was throwing me off. No, I mean, Katy Perry, I've someone who's tracked her career.
She's a hard worker.
She's a hard worker and she's growing. I appreciate that about her.
I appreciate that about her because she actually, she's 10 or so years in the game. She started out as a Christian singer. Yeah. So she's come a long way. I mean, she's always been kind of counterculture compared to where she was raised, in the Santa Barbara church, whatever that is.
I love that documentary, that piece. What is that? Part of Me? That
Part of Me.
That's such a great movie. I mean, I started loving Katy Perry after that. But I mean,
I actually really like the song. Like, I was
it's
confused.
Growing on me.
I was confused by the visuals, but I liked the song a lot.
Yes.
Well, I want to talk to you guys about Bruno Mars because I know you're a major stan, and I know you have an interesting theory about his Prince performance, and I have to admit, I am a skeptic. I am not a Bruno person, and yes, I am, and I'm hoping you guys can either convince me to see the light, or I will just fight with you.
Poplar, I can listen to 24 Karat Magic in the Air and any other of his hits on repeat for hours, if need be.
He's every bit as versatile, talented, multifaceted as somebody like Justin Timberlake. Uh-huh. But the fact that he's brown and a little bit shorter makes him
pocket size.
Less. Yeah, he's pocket size. He's a pocket size butch. He's a little less. I mean, it means that he doesn't ascend to the same levels of kind of stratospheric. I don't know. Again, a kind of respectability or acceptance. And I know that a lot of people mocked him donning the Prince outfit during the Prince tribute. But I do have to say, we have to also remember the context Bruno Mars comes from. He's Puerto Rican, Filipino, from Hawaii. He grew up with show people, not unlike my own parents. I mean, who drilled it into him? Like, you've always got to deliver. You've always got to perform. You've got to make the audience happy. And that ethos not only comes from his performing family, but also from, this kind of shared colonial history. Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and the Philippines were all annexed to the U.S. in 1898. And in many respects, the best and most consummate cover musicians in the world are Filipinos. In fact, that's one of the biggest exports from the Philippines are Filipino musicians.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Who cover American artists and, in fact, who've been said to perform better than the original. And so I'm not saying that Bruno did that. I'm just saying we have to contextualize what he's doing. Also, based on
he's
this really rich history.
He's a consummate performer.
He killed that guitar lick. I mean, also, it's like, who else is going to be able to, like, do everything else and then add the guitar thing to it?
It's funny because you guys are making a brilliant case for him, and I think I hear everything you're saying, and yet I feel like these ideas about him being a consummate performer and that he basically was groomed and in a similar way to Beyonce, it sounds like, that's kind of exactly my sticking point with him, is that I never feel like he breaks out of that mold of being like the people-pleasing performer who's going to put the smile on your face and then razz-dazz, metazzle, get off the stage.
Know who else is like that? Dick Van Dyke. And he's 90 freaking something years old. And that
but
man never fails to entertain.
Break loose. I want him to seriously feel like he is breaking out.
We can't have too many of those people. But you know what?
I want a little fuck you energy from him. Almost.
I want fuck you energy, but you know these people get tired of the fuck you energy. You know,
this guy was homeless and living in his car and living in one room with like 12 siblings or whatever the hell in Hawaii. And I think that just to like kind of get deep academic here, I was like, you can't. You know, as a post-colonial subject, you can never be authentic. I mean, that's the one thing. You can never have authenticity when you're already seen as always imitating the more powerful nation, the more powerful race.
I love
kind of
that.
Thing,
I'm rooting
you know?
It down.
And
that's
so it's sort
so
of like you will always be a mimic. You will never be authentic. And I think that that's one of the things that lingers over him. And I think that he is authentic insofar as he's authentically Puerto Pino. You know, he's Puerto Rican Filipino, authentically doing the thing that we do, and to bring it to this broader audience in the stage and have people start to respect his talent and his abilities to be so versatile, to be chameleonic, I think that's important.
Yeah. All right, guys, I will try harder with Bruno Mars. Fine. Okay. You've been listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
My name is Patrick.
My name is Parker.
Max Fun Con has been a huge inspiration in my life.
Now I have this network of friends that I've made that span literally across the entire globe, and they're some of my favorite people in the world.
I truly cannot believe the amount of wonderful and lasting friendships that have come out of this.
If you feel like you might not fit in, as long as you're a good person, you'll fit in because everyone there is good and amazing and kind and wonderful, and you should absolutely go. It will be the best decision of your life.
Make a ton of new friends like Parker and Patrick at Max FunCon. Tickets for Max FunCon and Max FunCon East are on sale now at maxfuncon.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell
and Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask something. I don't remember what that question is. Karen, do you know what it is?
What's your jam?
Close enough. What do you got?
In honor of Prince's music now being available to streaming services, I thought I would share one of my favorite Prince songs that isn't particularly flashy, but always gave me a kind of warm, huggy feeling inside. And that, in part because the video featured Prince hanging out with Muppets. And it's Starfish and Coffee from Sign of the Times, 1987.
7:45 on the line to teach Miss Kathleen. First was Kevin, then came Lucy. Third in line was me. All of us were ordinary compared to Cynthia Rose. She always stood at the back of the line, a smile beneath her nose. Her favorite number was 20, and every single day. If you ask her what you had for breakfast, this is what she'd say. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds and a tangerine.
Anyway, you
it's
know,
so sweet. That song is so sweet.
It's a sweet song. It's yeah. If I ever have kids, that'll be one of the songs I play for them. And we put so much emphasis on Prince's nasty, sexy stuff and the party like it's 1999 and let's go crazy. But this particular song to me is, this is the one that when I heard Prince died, I went to first and just had a really good cry.
So my song, my jam of the week, is coming from this wonderful Spotify list that Fortet put together. Fortet is basically this like electronica post-rock musician from England, Kieran Hebden, who works with all kinds of people from the Middle East, including Omar Suleiman, who, if you haven't gone and checked him out, he's a really crazy listen, basically a wedding singer turned pop star. And he put together this playlist that has songs from all of the banned countries on Trump's list. And one of the discoveries I made off of this list is this Iranian early pioneer of psychedelic rock named Kharush Yagmeh. Sorry if I'm botching that pronunciation. He was really active before the Iranian Revolution, and this is a song called Layla. He has a really beautiful voice, and apparently he would play in different Iranian coffee shops, covers of Beatles and all things like that. And if you're from Iran or are connected to the music, you're going to recognize him, and I'm happy to make his discovery through this Spotify list. So go check it out. Basically, look up Fortet. It doesn't have a name, the Spotify list. It's just a bunch of symbols. So look up Fortet and look up his playlists, and you'll find it. Winter, what do you got for us?
My song of the week is by Bumbada, who is a Jamaican Californian. And this song is just like, it just came out 3 weeks ago. It is, I don't know, it's been on straight up replay in the house. So this song is definitely something that is four quadrants. I haven't said that in a while, and that's because I haven't felt it in a while. But this is a certified quadrant, all four song. I love this song. It's called Unconditional. Sex begins.
Sexy Cynthia. It's very sexy, like, yeah. Miami Vice sexy.
It reminds me of like a less
Trans Am riding.
Yeah. Oh yes. Oh yes. But it also kind of reminds me of Goodbye Horses.
What's Goodbye Horses?
It basically is the song that it's been co-opted as the Silence of the Lambs song. When, what's his name? What was the name of the serial killer?
Hannibal Lecter.
No.
Buffalo Bill. Christian chimed in with a quickness on that.
Oh, yeah. I, a little frighteningly quick.
Yeah.
Buffalo Bill.
It puts the lotion in the basket.
In the bucket of fiestas.
Or else you get the hose again.
Just know that
this is what happens when no boys are in the booth.
No
it's
boys
true.
In the booth.
It just went into full kind of amaze.
Anyway, it's a great song. I like it. It's sexy.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Margaret Wappler, with Winter Mitchell and Karen Thompson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to CapVT for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. What are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Love us anymore? Nobody reviews it anymore. Let's get on it. Come on. If you haven't already, please, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. Or join our Facebook group and join the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the man who squinted at me earlier when I made a joke about millennials, Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.